We'd like to welcome you this morning to our next session. We are honored and pleased to have Daniel Stone here with us, who's the author of William Bickerton, Forgotten Latter-day Saint Prophet. I'm Casey Paul Griffiths. I work at Brigham Young University, and I'm the session moderator. We're also pleased to have with us Benjamin E. Park from Sam Houston State University. He's going to serve as one of our critics. Christopher Blythe, who is associated with the Neil A. Maxwell Institute at Brigham Young University, who's going to be another one of our critics. And participating in spirit but not in body, Christina Rossetti and Barbara Morgan Gardner, who both read the book and have offered some comments. Before we get started, I want to introduce Daniel Stone and just take a moment to let you know him. Daniel Stone holds a PhD in American religious history from Manchester Metropolitan University in England. He's the author of William Bickerton, Forgotten Latter-day Saint Prophet, and has taught history courses at the University of Detroit Mercy and Florida Atlantic University. Currently, he works as a private research archivist in a private library and archive in Detroit, Michigan. And it's been my pleasure the last few years to know Daniel in a number of different settings, whether it's professional conferences like this or less professional settings. Daniel came to visit BYU and teach us a little bit about his movement and his church. And we even played, what did we play together, like the game of life or something? And it got really intense. But Daniel remained a gentleman throughout the proceedings. So my respect for him is immense, and I'm incredibly happy to be here. So we'll begin first with Christopher Blythe. Just before we begin, so you know, this book has been published by Signature in the last few years. We're going to talk a little bit about why it's special and unique as the session goes on. As time progresses, we want to have a lot of time to answer questions and to discuss the book and to ask Daniel about his research process and how this has affected him in his life. So I'll turn the time over to Christopher, and we'll proceed from there.
Great. It's great to be here, and it's great to comment on Daniel Stone's book. I've gotten the chance to review this a few times now. So I've reviewed it once online, so you got a hint of my thoughts. And then I have another review I'm completing for a journal that Ben edits, Mormon Studies Review. And so I've thought a lot about this work, and I'm a fan. I like it a lot. And we'll talk about some of that. So historiographically, where do I place this book in the literature? And I think it's really important. Steve Shields, if Daniel Stone didn't exist, this is it's a wonderful life situation. If we pulled him out of the situation, we would be left with a very limited Bickertonite historiography so far as the broader Mormon studies community is aware of. We had an essay written in Scattering of the Saints that came out with John Whitmer Books a while ago, a pretty limited sort of church history essay. And then we had the work of Stephen Shields. Stephen Shields did something, some of you probably are aware of his work. He's an RLDS 70, or excuse me, a Community of Christ 70, who's a former LDS member, and became deeply interested in the sort of what he calls expressions of the Restoration. So Steve's a guy who sort of counts and catalogs and pulls things together. One of the influential essays that Steve wrote back in the day is in an anthology called When Prophets Die. This anthology includes all sorts of different new religious movements, and he was invited to write the essay on the Latter-day Saint tradition. In that essay, Steve makes an argument that's been repeated many times, that there are six strains of the Restoration, that there is this idea that you could trace the vast majority of communities that exist today either through a Brighamite strain or a Hedrickite strain or Joseph Smith III, Cutler. And Bickerton fits in there because he is in this reading from Sidney Rigdon's heritage. One of the things I was so excited about when I read this book and started to think about what it can tell us about the Bickertonites is that that's really a misreading. If I'm reading Daniel correctly, Bickerton is fascinating because he's one of these few important historical Latter-day Saint in a broader sense, who joined the Restoration in a time period after Joseph Smith's death through one of these communities that prospered, right? So you can think William Blair. He's an important figure in RLDS history. He found the Restoration through joining William Smith's church, 1845, really similar. Bickerton found the Restoration by joining Sidney Rigdon's community in Philadelphia, also in 1845. And he became passionate about the Restoration, broadly, obviously. And this particular branch is going to have an influence on his life, but it would be completely wrong. And Daniel should oppose this if I'm wrong. We'll see if he does. But it'd be completely wrong, if I'm reading Daniel's work correctly, to see the Bickertonite community of today to have a heritage going straight to Sidney Rigdon. Sidney Rigdon's community lasts about a year. Bickerton then doesn't stay sort of in limbo until he founds his own community. Rather, just like everyone else in the Restoration, he's questioning, what do we do now? Where do we go? What communities and what relationships should I have? And so we see that Bickerton becomes a Brighamite, right? He has an idea that maybe this is the way. Here's a community that's at least sort of established and less volatile than the community Sidney Rigdon has that can fall apart within a year. And that doesn't work out for him. In fact, through 19th century sources that Stone quotes, we see that a central part of Bickertonite identity is a response to polygamy. Just like Community of Christ, or RLDS community, just like the Cutlerites that were founded in 1853, as a response to Brighamite Mormonism, not as a sort of coherent and unmessy lineage coming out of a martyrdom moment where we have this sort of birth of six movements. It's not how it happens. This book does a wonderful job showing the sort of messiness that is Restoration history of the 1840s and 1850s. And I think that deserves a great deal of praise. We need to question narratives that are too smooth. There's a great deal that makes William Bickerton unique. And for me, there's also some, let's try again, one more comment on historiography. So Mormon studies is in its adolescence. It's not in its infancy, right? I see scholars, Lawrence Foster, I see Michael Marquardt. We've been writing, speaking of that community, for a long time, and a lot of things have been underturned. Stephen Shields, I mentioned already. A lot of stuff. John Whitmer Historical Association has a conference every year and publishes now twice a year. If I was going to critique this work in any way, it's that I want more of an interaction with that material. I think Daniel does wonderful when it comes to positioning William Bickerton in a sort of antebellum historiography, the sort of stuff that your advisor says to you, hey, tell me about coal miners, because he was a coal miner. I want you to insert coal mining and wages and all that great stuff into this material. But as a person in an actual discipline that this is seated in, I want to know not just that you read Quinn. I want you to say, Marquardt tells us something about patriarchal blessings. And as I'm talking about the revelatory mind of these early Bickertonites that have all sorts of interesting things that are in conversation with that, I want to see how it relates to the ideas and arguments that have already been established. One of the great things in this book is the emphasis on democratic revelation of the Bickertonites, the idea of ritual among the Church of Jesus Christ, particularly. We see fascinating things that today we associate with Pentecostals or holiness movement, right? Washing of feet in a public setting. We see speaking in tongues. We see prophecy given in meeting. And Daniel, I'm thinking this is correctly. If Tana Lynn had a prophecy and this was a Bickertonite service, maybe she could stand up and give it to us?
Oh, for
right? So sit down, Tom Lim. All right. But a sort of thing that we'd probably see in most likely in holiness or Pentecostal settings, right? So I want to know, one of the things I'm deeply interested in, and you address it a little bit, is we also have these things in an 1836 Kirtland setting. Bickerton comes around 1845, has these influences of Rigdon that are really important in his lives. Now, is he, when he's introducing washing of feet to his community broadly, which women participate in too, right? It has a Pentecostal angle to it. It's democratic. Women are participating. We're doing it when? When do we perform the ordinance?
Oh, feet washing?
Yeah.
Oh, from the very beginning.
The beginning? Is it seasonal?
No. They now it's seasonal, but back then they were just doing it sporadically. It wasn't like a planned thing. It was very much done extemporaneously by the Holy Spirit, just whenever they felt to do it.
Fascinating. So I'm wondering, so in Pentecostal communities today, from an Anabaptist tradition, it's seasonal, right? We have seasonal performance of feet washing, usually around Easter and other important times of the year, sometimes as a sort of larger event planned. And then in the early Restoration, it's performed in certain major events like the Kirtland Temple endowment. So what's going on here, right? Am I dealing with a sort of, Pentecostals aren't founded until 1900, right? So we're talking about an earlier form, which we can document in holiness communities and things. Is Bickerton being influenced by that West Virginia, sort of, I'm right? West Virginia? Yeah. West Virginia folk traditions going on in sort of these communities? Or is this really a restoration base that he's pulled down from Rigdon's material? I'd like those sorts of analysis being pulled out. I think it's as your work moves on, I'd love to see those sorts of questions being asked. And again, I think the historiography when it comes to American history generally, it's great. We have a great positioning of this community. When it comes to the sort of scattering of the saints material, it could be benefited by a little more positioning. So wonderful things that we see are exceptional in the Bickertonite community that could be contextualized and have us ask, how exceptional is this? And I think that answer might be very exceptional, or we might temper it, right? So race relations. Bickertonites in 1872 have a community revelation. They say some members don't want African-American members of the church. They have a revelation that says, no, Acts 10, right? Peter seeing this, who art thou to call this unclean, right? The revelation about the Gentiles is applied then to African-Americans in this community, saying, of course, they're members just like white members or any other group. A really important conversation that's happening there in 1872, what is the larger conversation about race that's happening in Mormonism broadly? William Smith's having that question in 1845, not so many miles away. Sidney Rigdon, I don't know of sources where he's having that question. Joseph Smith III is going to do a modified understanding of race where he says, blacks are wonderful, we're going to ordain them to priests, but we're not going to give them the Melchizedek priesthood, right? So there's all these sorts of positions, and then, of course, we know Brigham Young's sort of route. But there's some modified things that Bickerton is certainly the most progressive that I know of. And 1872 is this opening, and then we know it gets much better, too, right? It's a sort of trajectory. But I'd like to see that positioning broader done. The same's true of Messianism. William Bickerton will declare himself, he talks about a revelation where he's a John the Baptist figure to prepare for the second coming. He wants to focus on Indian ministries because that's so important to prophecy. I'd be interested in seeing that rooted in other conversation. I think Daniel's actually been thinking about this since the book, right? Other conversations about Messianism, how can the one mighty and strong, the Davidic servant, or in this case, he calls himself the choice seer, is that right? Yeah. The choice seer, preparing the way for a sort of fixing of the restoration that happened at Joseph's death. Fascinating. Bickerton has some amazing ideas on how to do that. Other ideas are going around in the community. So it'd be interesting to see what the conversation is happening, the similarities or the differences there. Now, it's not fair to say that one has to do that, right? This is a wonderful book that brings us into William Bickerton's life and shows that conversation for him that becomes really heated, right? He has all these ideas for this religion, and the group that he discovers is really democratic. So what I love about this is that William Bickerton has a conversation with his flock, and when they don't like him, they can unseat him. Now, that's fascinating, guys. This doesn't happen in the Restoration. We talk about democratized religion in America. Mormonism is not a good example. It doesn't function like this. But the Bickertonites have a fascinating narrative that Daniel brings out well. In fact, hopefully when Daniel speaks, he'll talk about that positioning of Bickerton in his own tradition. How does this historiography play down? Daniel, it's so difficult. How do you judge a biography? It's like, yeah.
You turned off your microphone.
Did I? I did. How do I turn it back on? It sounded like it's in business there. All right, where did you guys lose out?
Just a minute.
Okay. There it is, guys. It really was me. I was doing the Dwight Schrute thing. Yeah. All right. So, what was I saying? Not that I have a set narrative that I'm going to
judge a biography.
Judging a biography. So, this is essential. If I was going to name this book, I think people buy biographies. It's the right way to sell this book. If I was going to rename it, I'd call it William Bickerton and the Formation of a New Restoration Tradition, right? I think so much of the book is based on the founding of this community rather than William Bickerton as a person. When it comes to William Bickerton as a person, we don't have great sources. So we're using a lot. This 1903 statement from William Bickerton where he weighs back on his decisions through his life. He writes this autobiography. Now, I'm 38 now, middle-aged, younger middle-aged. As I look back on my life, I've changed a lot, right? If I think about my fraternity days, my inactivity in Mormonism days, I have a different spin on it now than I did in my 20s. I like to tell the story a lot cleaner. I like to see a purpose at the end of it. So it's a struggle if we're going to take a source in 1903 after Bickerton's been burned by his community, after he has made all sorts of decisions along the way, to trust that source for 60 years before. But it's the best we have. So Daniel is forced to do that. He's also forced to use a methodology of analogy, of comparison. So William Bickerton was against plural marriage. We know that. Well, maybe he was like so-and-so that was against plural marriage. It's a way of doing it. It's not the best way to do it, but we're forced to do it in this situation. And that shows some archival work that's important. So I would say we have limited sources. We also have wonderful sources. And it's particularly why I want that other subtitle there, is because when it comes to the sources of the community, and Daniel, speak to the, when you talk, since we have a little time, speak to the controversy. There's no one here that, right? You can speak to the controversy? Okay.
As long as no one's recording me, I'm going to send it to the apostles of my church.
Okay. There's a controversy around sources, and because of that, you don't, the way you use your footnotes, you don't say, this meeting,
yep.
Notes of minutes of this meeting, you cite them all in one chunk,
yep.
Which is confusing to some people. But we actually have wonderful minutes here of communities that are vibrant and argumentative and, of course, sacred and spiritual. And those sources that are brought out in this book are worth the price of admission. And Daniel's going to do a lot more work with that over the years. I also think How long have I spoken, guys?
You're at 20.
I should shut up, huh?
No,
all right. All right. Daniel Stone, I think, also represents a really exciting time in Mormon studies. We have a bright new scholar who has a background that's not typical of our scholarly community. We're doing better in the sort of obvious diversity things. We're making slow progress. We're working hard on trying to find racial and fixing gender disparity in our scholarly voices. We have a way to go. But intellectually, it's exciting when we have a voice that's coming from a community that's restoration, but has a different slant, an intellectual diversity that I think we should certainly be taking advantage of. I hope he's already on the board of editors in Mormon History Association. I hope that he continues to find ways of contributing and people pull him in when there's possibilities of that, because it's exciting to have a Bickerton-Knight scholar that's not an apologist, right? There's no sort of Bickerton-Knights are portrayed warmly and accurately, and there's a love that Daniel has for his faith community. But just like the work that best Mormon studies scholars do from any tradition, I mean, he's Roger Launius or David Howland from Community of Christ or so forth. I'm sure there's something offensive in all this last two paragraphs of my statement, but I'm really excited about it. So thank you for your time.
I kind of want to forego my time and just hear about the sources, so we'll just look forward to that. It's hard following Chris Blythe because he knows this stuff so much better than I will, so I fear my comments are going to pale in comparison. However, he does afford me the opportunity that, since he can get into the nitty-gritty details of the book, that allows me to just kind of float above everything and just make 10,000-foot observations. My first scholarly conference that I ever attended was a John Whitmer Historical Association meeting in Kirtland, Ohio. Ever since then, I've firmly believed in what I'm calling, for the purposes of this paper, the broader Mormon diaspora, the significance of incorporating divergent traditions that claim heritage back to Joseph Smith. I feel comfortable in this fascination, too, as Greg Prince's recent biography of Leonard Arrington emphasized how an interdenominational dialogue has always remained crucial to MHA's mission, a commitment that I'm happy to say continues in today's association. The board of directors, program chairs, and journal editors, everyone attached to MHA, all try to keep that dynamic in mind, the divergent Mormon expressions, which is one of the reasons I'm thrilled to be part of this roundtable today, especially on a book that deservedly won MHA's Best Biography Award last night.
Congrats, Daniel.
Now, I'll return to why I think this line of study is significant in a few moments, because I think the reasoning might be a tad different than what others who share these priorities. But first, I want to highlight some of the important contributions, as well as what I find significant questions that come from Daniel's biography of William Bickerton. It is one thing to dig into the life of an overlooked figure within an overlooked movement, but quite another when that very figure should not have been overlooked in the first place. William Bickerton was one of the more successful prophetic figures in the Mormon diaspora at a moment when its schismatic tendencies were at a fever pitch. I'd argue that the decade between 1844 and 1854 were the zenith of Mormon fissuring, at least outside of Utah, and Bickerton's faith was one of the more sustainable. That Bickerton later experienced a fall from grace should not overshadow the formidable figure he carved during his early years as a leader of the Church of Jesus Christ. He was less militant than Brigham Young, more stable than Sidney Rigdon, less extremist than James Strang, and more consistent than William Smith. Just from a historical point alone, Bickerton's story needed to be told, and Stone has finally produced a thoughtful and exhaustive account for us. Given this general dearth of knowledge concerning Bickerton, Stone's treatment required, at a basic level, an exhaustive detailing of the whos, whats, wheres, and whens of his life and ministry, and, more crucially to Stone's approach, a detailed overview of his theological evolution. This is, I believe, both the biggest strength and perhaps one of the weaknesses of the volume. Stone is to be commended at how tedious he is at tracing Bickerton's ideas, his readings of the Bible, the Book of Mormon, and Joseph Smith's revelations, as well as the Bickertonite revelations themselves, in order to present a complete worldview. Further, this is often marshaled for the case of comparison. Stone wants to demonstrate how Bickerton related to other Latter-day Saint prophets, particularly with regard to race and gender. In order to situate this forgotten prophet within the Mormon diaspora, then, we have to first understand what made him unique. But out of this anxiety grows yet another, the need to systematize. That is, in order to render a comparison between Bickerton and others, Brigham Young, William Smith, others, we need a coherent view of his theology. But is coherency possible in this case? As it is quickly apparent, at least in the early chapters, Bickerton did not leave an extensive written record. A William Bickerton papers project would be a difficult endeavor. Most of what Stone meticulously pieces together come from later reminiscences, apologia, and memoirs, texts created in different contexts and in response to different questions. This is one instance in which the need to rediscover a forgotten father, or forgotten figure, crashes headfirst into the realities of historical amnesia. We are led down the quest to do what is impossible. Stone is very clear in how he attempts to overcome this issue. In the introduction, he insists that the job of the biographer is to create a narrative that, quote, more or less reflects the views of the subject. I'm not sure that's entirely true. There is certainly a common biographical approach, sometimes called the hermeneutics of generosity, that perhaps best representative Richard Bushman's biography of Joseph Smith, but that's not merely reflecting the views of the subject. First and foremost, such a task is impossible given the historical distance and paucity of sources. But moreover, a biographer is meant to analyze rather than merely reflect the life and world of their source. Now, Stone certainly does this at various points, but it is still important to note the methodological commitment as outlined. Take, for example, the many block quotes in the text. Stone justifies these by explaining he is analyzing texts that have not been made available to researchers before, so it is necessary to get them into the open. This is something Chris highlighted, and it's kind of guerrilla documentary editing, getting these documents out that might not otherwise be accessible, right? But we also need to know what comes along, the consequences of that approach. Yet these block quotes are sometimes a substitute for analysis, a conscious decision to suspend the critical eye in favor of merely, to quote once again, reflecting the views of those under consideration. Further, these block quotes give a sense of stability and coherence, attributes that I fear can be chipped away through closer analysis. This isn't to say that Stone failed in his initiative. Far from it. I think he succeeds admirably. I found the body of the book a lively and persuasive work. But I also think it should be seen as a starting point for Bickerton studies, laying the foundation that now needs to be built upon or in some cases chipped away. Such is the nature of the biographer's task, especially when dealing with, once again, a forgotten figure. Indeed, even as Stone does a remarkable job reconstructing Bickerton's life in the context of Civil War America, scholars can now move forward by explaining why Bickerton's life is relevant to these broader developments. Just put it another way, rather than just seeing Mormonism and at times America through Bickerton's eyes, which Stone does very well, what we also need to do is to view Bickerton through the eyes of America. Now, I'd like to return to the theme with which I opened my remarks, the significance of Mormon diasporic studies. On the one hand, the significance of studying people like Bickerton should be clear. Without them, the story is just incomplete. To have an exhaustive Mormon history, especially now that Mormon is freed from Utah-based institutions, we need to be more comprehensive in terms of the groups and individuals who claim an authoritative lineage from Joseph Smith. But I'd also like to tease out two other reasons, one parochial and one integrative in nature. The first concerns the Mormon studies field in general. Studying marginalized traditions disrupts simplistic theological narratives of Mormon development. There's your 10-cent word sentence to get you through the day. Put in other words, Mormonism did not have to develop the way it did. None of the Mormon traditions, lineages, trajectories were predetermined to develop the way they did. And we know that because we see people taking multiple trajectories from a single starting point. Bickerton read the same Book of Mormon as Joseph Smith, yet he interpreted it in fundamentally different ways at certain points. He also inherited the same Doctrine and Covenants that Brigham Young also inherited, but structured a very different ecclesiastical system. Using the same clay from which the Utah saints built a patriarchal, millenarian, and racial system, Bickerton developed one that was arguably more progressive in each of those categories. I was struck how, within months of converting to Sidney Rigdon's religion, Bickerton was already questioning Rigdon's decisions in Revelation, something that Chris already brought up. What was it about their community that put such a premium on personal freedom rather than strict obedience? Mormonism, in other words, was never determined to develop in any particular way. Mormon theology is a malleable organism that blends and shapes according to different individuals and contexts. By understanding the ways in which Bickerton created Mormonism in his likeness and image, we get a better understanding of the ways Brigham Young, James Strang, and Joseph III created theirs. If one of the historian's tasks is to reveal roads that were not chosen, rather than just the roads that were, Mormon schismatic studies should take up much more historical bandwidth than previously observed. Now the second, and I promise final, point, and it admittedly has to do more with Mormon studies than it does with Mormon history, so bear with me. If one of the key purposes of Mormon studies is to use Mormonism to better understand the world around it, rather than merely use the world around it to better understand Mormonism, then it seems a study of people like Bickerton and movements like the Bickertonites prove a crucial role. 19th century America was known for its religious marketplace, as citizens took advantage of a new disestablished culture, the separation of church and state, to sample divergent traditions and dabble in various denominations. As recent scholarship has shown, a majority of Americans changed faith at least once in their lifetime, and often more. Historians have struggled at explaining why this was and what it meant. Was this just the inevitable fruits of the religious marketplace of disestablishment? Did the American emphasis on the personal conscience equal to an unending stream of conversions and dissensions? Did the physical mobility of westward expansion lead many to believe they could up and leave their faith traditions just as easily as they could cities? What was it that made the faith of their fathers no longer acceptable for a majority of Americans? Enter the Mormons. Even for those who remained within the Mormon diaspora, individual choice led them to affiliate, leave, restore, or expose particular institutions in favor of others. These divergent Mormon traditions, I argue, finally, in this conclusion, might offer a key to unlocking one of the mysteries of American religious history more broadly. What was it about the national climate that allowed William Bickerton, a miner in rural West Virginia and Pennsylvania, to determine that, in lieu of merely following other prophets, he could actually become his own? Thank you.
We thank our two critics for their excellent, excellent papers and for their thoughtful analysis of Daniel's profound work. And I apologize for not mentioning that you won Best Biography last night. I was pleased to see that when I arrived here this morning. In the absence of two of our other critics, if it's okay, I've read the book as well, and we want to have a good discussion. But I had a couple questions that I just want to put out there to kind of prime the pump. Before we go into this, a few things that struck me, and I should state I come from a Utah Latter-day Saint background, so I'm working off of the Institutional Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There were a few things about the way Bickerton conducted himself that were especially interesting to me. One of them, Ben mentioned, the democratic nature of the Bickertonites. I was surprised to read within the story that often the direction the church was headed in was shifted by a person receiving a prophecy, a narrative, a vision, a revelation. This kind of Pentecostalism, which we don't see often within the Restoration, is interesting, and I'd like to know how it's expressed within your movement today. Secondly, I was fascinated by the concept of a choice seer that would be of Native American heritage, and how that wove itself in and out of the narrative, especially in regards to the ghost dance and Revoca and some of the interesting historical developments that happened in the latter part of the 19th century. Maybe to me, the most interesting thing about this story within the larger world of Mormonism is in the book, and I don't know how many of you have had a chance to read the book yet, there is a schism that happens within the Bickertonite movement between William Bickerton and William Cadman. And at the end of their lives, they die within 9 months of each other respectively, there is a reconciliation. As I was reading that, I thought, I can't think of a single other example where a schism reconciled and came back together. That is incredibly unique and says something wonderful about Bickerton or Cadman. I'd love to hear some commentary on that. The last thing is, as I've affiliated with Daniel and had multiple conversations with him, I hope this doesn't embarrass him, but on multiple occasions, me or one of my colleagues has referred to him as the Leonard Arrington of the Church of Jesus Christ, that he plays the same role that Leonard Arrington played within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints of professionalizing history within a movement. But and almost everybody here knows that that wasn't without some controversy and without some difficulty. Leonard Arrington struggled with the idea of being a faithful member of his church, but also writing history that was professional and maintained some emotional distance from the subject. Daniel, I think a fascinating part of your story that I'd love for you to share with us today has been your negotiation with the leaders of your own faith, and how some of the things, some of the discoveries which are in this book could be potentially explosive historically and have an impact on how your church views its history and how they relate to one another. So with that to kind of prime the pump, I'd like to take questions from the audience. Let's invite Daniel up here and let's give him a round of applause again for his remarkable work.
Christine, could you start by responding to us?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming, and thank you for the wonderful critiques. I'm one of those weird people, and I really do mean this. I really enjoy being critiqued, especially by really great scholars. I first want to talk about the presenters. So I was working with Signature, and we wanted to put together Author Meets Critics, and we asked these particular scholars, and unfortunately, Barbara Morgan Gardner and Christina Rossetti couldn't be here, and those are excellent scholars as well. Christina's at a funeral, and Barbara is in Jerusalem doing awesome things, so those are really good excuses. But the reason I asked these presenters is because, first of all, I've been following them for years, and I'll just give a little brief overview. I met Chris through his writings. He is by far, him and Casey, especially for diaspora Mormonism, they're the top-notch scholars. When I went to get my PhD, my PhD advisor was assigning articles written by Chris. And this is in England. So, I mean, it just goes to show you. Same thing for Casey. His an article on the Remnant Church is excellent that just came out last year in the Journal of Mormon History. So I asked these guys because they are the experts. Ben, he's been dealing with diaspora. And honestly, I've basically been an online groupie of Ben. I'm embarrassed to say. And if you don't follow his Twitter feed, you definitely need to. So I've been following him for years, and he's just been blowing it out of the water. And same thing with Christina. Christina does spiritualism, the fundamentalists, polygamy. So she was an awesome person to talk. And Barbara is really interested in women and family within Mormonism. So all these aspects, Bickerton has a major play in. They're all award winners. I wanted to get their perspective on it. And they really did give a wonderful critique and perspective on it. So I really, first of all, just wanted to say thank you. I absolutely agree with all the critiques. Believe it or not, I really do. I guess I'll just start with more historiography. I totally agree with that. And this is my methodology going into it. The book is 400 pages long. The narrative is 330 pages long. And then I have an appendix. And then, you know, you get the pictures and the index. So all together, the book is 400 pages. And as Ron, who's here, he is my editor, we cut the book down, too. So this is where I came into it, knowing full well that, you know, when you study history and you're in the academic world, it's really a major focus to focus on historiography. But I'm one of those people where I love historiography, but I also love narrative and I love biography. And there was really nothing written about Bickerton at all. The only person who ever written who really did a scholarly thing on him was Gary Entz, and wrote two great articles on him, and that was his life in Kansas, which was a springboard for my book. And Gary was really nice to write a nice blurb for the book. I basically agree with Gary's interpretations. I offer some clarifications on certain things because I had access to more documents, but Gary was spot on, and I was really thankful that Gary had, you know, sponsored this work as well and said, no, this is good, because him and I were in that same idea, and he's not a member of the church. He's not even a Latter-day Saint, so I was agreeing with Gary, and I'm a member of this church, and we were going in that same trajectory. So it was really interesting, and I was looking at documents that he didn't even have, and I was agreeing with his interpretation. So it goes to show you what Gary Entz, his monumental feat for Bickerton to get that foundation going was excellent. So basically, why did I do a narrative and not focus so much on the historiography? Is just basically because since there was absolutely no foundation, I thought to myself, this is a huge story. Bickerton lived till he was 90 years old. I do include bits and pieces of historiography as they brought out, but I don't go into the major details with it for two reasons. A, I figured if to compare it as a metaphor, I was thinking about it. If we have a house, to me, I look at the historiography as like the walls and the foundation for the floors. But the major foundation, you need to know at least who you're talking about. And nobody knew about William Bickerton. He is the most least talked about person within the Restoration. When I say that, what I mean by that is that he is a major figure. His church is now the third largest Latter-day Saint church in the world. And we have all these other things written about, like Joseph Smith III, James Strang, Alpheus Cutler, you know, Hedrick. I mean, the list goes on and on. There's books written about these guys, right? And nothing's written about Bickerton. So I literally just started from the ground up, and I thought, you know what? I love American history. I can tie Bickerton's story within the narrative of American history, and I can set the foundation and tell a really good narrative and what I call analytical narratives, which I think the best biographies, that's the way they do it, but also still keep it scholarly. So for some historians, this makes them like, you know, bite their tongue. But like when you look at David McCullough's writings or John Meacham, they're, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning authors, but they cause a lot of controversy within the historical field because they're so flowery at times, or they write such great narratives, but they sell a lot of books. And then you have great biographers within the academic world that are really scholarly, but, you know, sometimes they might lack a narrative. I tried to strike a balance between those worlds to get this book out there, because I wanted people in my church to read it too, because the reason, and I liked Chris's comment that it should have been named, you know, William Bickerton and the Foundations of Another Restoration Movement, I think, or something like that. Absolutely, totally agree with you, because it's not really it's a biography in a sense, but it's really how Bickerton shaped and led a church, and it's about the formation of that church with Bickerton's life. The reason I chose Forgotten Latter-day Prophet, and I worked with Signature to do this. A, it's a sexier title, so we like that. But also, Bickerton is forgotten. He's forgotten in the Latter-day Saint movement. He's also forgotten within his own church. And what Casey and all these, you know, all the other scholars brought up is that there's this split that happens within the Bickertonite movement. And Bickerton really gets tucked away. I grew up in the movement. I'm still a member of the movement. And I knew little about Bickerton. How many here are a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have never heard of Joseph Smith? It just doesn't happen. Now, I'll tell you right now, how many members of my church have never heard of William Bickerton? I could say, I would guess, maybe not 50, but at least 30, 40% could very well have only mentioned his name briefly, or maybe even know it in passing. He was forgotten, and it's controversial because my church, it's 23,000 members-ish worldwide, 23 countries, but within the United States and Canada, there is only about 3,000 of us. So there's more members in Africa and Mexico than there are in the United States and in India and all these other foreign places. So it makes you wonder, I basically had to, how do I put this? I had to strike a balance. And I knew getting into it that it was difficult. And so basically with the historiography, with restoration, race relations, messianism. I address those things. I love talking about it. When I wrote my dissertation, I focused on a lot of those things. And I'm actually working, so here's the thing. I did it in England. Palgrave Macmillan's a big publisher out there. My advisor, he published with Palgrave. So I actually pitched a smaller book to Palgrave Macmillan on the historiography of William Bickerton, because I thought, okay, maybe we'd get a wider write. They were very interested in doing it, but they basically said to me, we like it, but write more. And I was like, oh gosh. So I really have to dig more into it. And it kind of goes to show how William Bickerton really, within the academic world, he really needs to be more contextualized. And that's what I hope to do. And this really is a starting point. With any book starting it off, let me put it this way too. If I were to give a metaphor imagery, I looked at the book as almost like a grenade. Because I'm a historian, but I'm also a member of the church. So I knew if I were to write something, I was literally throwing a grenade into my church, blowing it up. And then after the pieces go away, I'm able to kind of piece it together and do things. Because I really wanted to see the reaction to it. I'm so thankful. Within the Latter-day Saint community and the scholarly community, I'm really humbled and thankful that it's been well received. Within my church, it's split. I get a lot of people that say they like it, and I get a lot of people that say that they're angry about it. Some people just don't care, but some people are genuinely angry about it. Very educated, you know, people. The issue is because when Bickerton, and this is where we go to the forgotten Latter-day Prophet, when Bickerton gets tucked away and there's this reconciliation, which I'll let you all read in the book because it's a very long story, but basically there's this split for 22 years. There's the Church of Jesus Christ, Bickerton's church, is split in two, and eventually there's a reconciliation. The problem is Bickerton does not become the prophet anymore. He has to step down, he becomes an elder, and his biggest rival becomes the president of the whole church. And there are no more Bickerton descendants left in the church, but there are a lot of descendants and people that favor the latter side of the story. All the histories that were written by the church favor that story of, like, basically his name's William Cadman. Basically that William Cadman almost kind of like saved the church. You know, like he came in and Bickerton is looked at as a penitent that came into the church. He committed adultery, but he asked for forgiveness, which I basically contradict and I push against. It's hard for people to see that. And so I've had very heated discussions personally with people, even a little bit online. And that is not something, so I love being critiqued, but it's hard when it's in your own church and you're getting it personally and it's affecting your membership. And my membership was never in danger, but it affects those personal kinship relations, especially because we're so small. We know everybody, right? And everybody knows everybody. So it's been hard. So I wanted to talk about the minutes and the sources because everybody brought that up. So let me give you, Chris brought up a really good point. So I used a lot of typescripts of the original minutes. So when I first wanted to write the Bickerton story, all I had access, I had to write a letter to the apostles to get access to the archive, which was not in good shape. Now it's in much better shape. They have volunteer archivists that have done a really good job. It was a hot mess. And they've actually found cooler things since I've even been in there. So this is, again, this is a foundation. But I was given a typescript made by an assistant general historian of all the minute books. And there's about 14 or 15 minute books. And he made a big, meaty transcription. It's excellent. And he even has, like, little commentaries of what he thinks about certain things. And I had to get special permission to get this. I had to write a letter to the apostles. They had to review it. I had to get permission. And then I eventually get this wonderful typescript. That is all. The original minutes, as far as I knew, didn't even exist. They were lost for the ages. So I thought, okay, well, this is a really good transcription. It's very well done. We have the commentary from the assistant historian. So that's what I was using. About halfway through the book, so this is kind of give you the controversy behind this, I find out that the original minutes actually exist. I'm like, wait, what? And they didn't tell me that. And I was given this later on because I think they saw that I was being accepted by the community, and I was able to get sources from outside. So I was told, listen, there was an elder who had left the church who basically took the minutes. And that's a big controversy. The church says he stole them. That gentleman said that who owns his own archive, private archive in his home, says that he kept them so they would be preserved because the church was going to destroy them. That's his argument. So you see, it's heated. And they said, we've been trying for years under low key to try to get them back, and we can't get them back. Would you contact him? So what I did was, is I thought, well, I'm a member of the church. He's not going to trust me. He's never given them to anybody in the church. But I had this idea. I said, you know, I know this woman who knows a friend of his. Let me ask her to get, put in a good word for me to his friend and ask her to ask the friend if he could put in a good word for me. And then that's exactly what I did. And that's how I was able to get access to these wonderful minutes that were, he took photocopies, digital photographs of everything. He did typescripts of all of them. It was beautiful. So not only did I have the originals, but I had good typescripts that were text searchable. It was glorious. And I have accessible page numbers, right? Because I just got everything digitally. But here's the issue. He made me sign a contract that I would not give this stuff to the church, which really got my church mad. So now I'm like stuck, and I'm like, shoot, what am I gonna do? Because I want this to be a scholarly work. My church is, and I'm doing this under the auspices of the church. I'm giving them first publication rights, and now I have these minutes that are technically stolen, or that's how they view it, and I can't give it to them. So needless to say, my church under the historical committee was not pleased. So then I decide. So then I give the first half of the book to the apostles. I ask them, are you interested in publishing this? I never got a response back. And I was told by the general historian who was overlooking things, looking at the prose and everything. He says, you know, Daniel, you know, he was in favor of the book. He disagreed with me. We had, you know, like we have, like with any scholars, we had some friendly disagreements, but nothing major. But he was like, you know, it's a good book, but I don't know if the apostles are going to do it. And you're going to have to work with them. And I just basically was like, listen, you know, is it possible that I can just go independent with this? And I worked with him, and he said, yes, you can do that. When the apostles found out, I don't know how many, but I know some of them were not pleased about that. I received a letter from them asking that I would not publish independently. They asked me not to talk about basically the second half of the book. They basically said, please don't talk about it. So it was hard, and I had to write a letter back to them saying, I didn't think my membership was in danger, but I had to put my membership on the line and say, like, no, I am going to publish this. And Signature was nice enough to do it. So then I have, well, shoot, what am I going to do? Because now I have basically all the minutes I have digital photocopies and I have typescripts of them. They basically have everything. But I also have the stuff that was in the archive. And there's stuff in the archive that John didn't have, who I got the original minutes from, and vice versa. So to strike a balance, so this is like scholarship also playing politics. I never thought in my wildest dreams I'd have to do this, because most people would be like, just use the stuff you got from, you know, John Mancini, he's a great guy, just use his stuff, that you have everything. But here's the issue, if I do that, nobody in my church is gonna read the book because it's all that stuff. So and the typescripts that were in the church were really good. So I thought, well, I'll use both. I'll use Idris Martin's general, who is the assistant general historian, I'll use his as the main thing, the meat. And then when I get into Kansas and the things that the church doesn't have, I'll use John's. And then I have, and it, so it was a balance that I am still proud of to this day that I struck. And I never wanted to play politics doing this, but you know, Signature was very kind and did that. And so, I mean, you could argue maybe some of the typescripts the typescripts might have some typographical errors or things like that. If I was going to do a documentary history, I would have definitely used the originals, absolutely, because you have everything. But those typescripts have the meat of everything. And I'm writing a narrative. I'm writing a biography. There might be minor typographical errors that I didn't catch, you know, but you can spot check it and see. The typescripts were good. And I had accessible page numbers that people could go. Because also, here's the other thing. Both archives are restricted. You can't get into them. So what's more accessible? The good typescripts that can be sent electronically. And those are the things that I can actually cite and have accessible page numbers. So that is the story, the story behind all that. It's complicated, but it's good stuff, and it's a great foundation to start off with it. And it's hard because then you might... Basically, I don't want to get into all the nitty-gritty of all the things that were said to me privately with, like, in a church. I talk with Chris a lot about this. But basically, they're mad. Some people are mad, and people who favor the Cadman narrative are mad at me because I have contradicted the Cadman narrative. I'm using sources as they brought out. You can't tell a biography of Bickerton because we don't really have a lot of his writings. You're absolutely right. But you know what? I love microhistory, and if Laura Thatcher Ulrich can do it and Quincy Newell can do it, then by golly, I'm going to try it too. So it's a fun thing to do, to get your hands into it. And as they all brought out perfectly, his story needed to be told. And within American religion, especially within the Restoration Movement, sometimes the best place to start when you're writing a narrative and you're going to start about a movement, you know, we're all focused about the bottom-up studies. We want to know about the common people. But leaders are important, too. And especially within the Restoration, leaders and prophets move and shake the movement. If you're going to understand Mormonism, you better understand Joseph Smith and how he thought, because he was the prophet. It's a great place to start off with an American religion, and especially within the Latter-day Saint movement. So I knew I needed to start with Bickerton. And for, you know, publication purposes, more people read biography. So it's a good thing to start off with that. And I love biography. That was one of my focuses when I was writing my dissertation. So I really appreciate that. But the issue with that is, like, so you have these stolen minutes, and then also, by the way, the general historian of the church said some things in there, and he had issues with publishing. He wanted to get his stuff out. So basically, the church has always kept this stuff hidden. Not hidden. It's been tucked away. Because the church has evolved over time, right? Now the church says they don't believe in the Doctrine and Covenants at all. But you see William Bickerton believed in the Doctrine and Covenants, or at least in some of them, and he used them quite a bit. That's controversial, because now everybody in the church is like, we're so focused on separate, I can speak for myself, and some people might disagree with me, but I grew up my whole life like this, at least this was my, I was supposed to not like the Mormons, right? I was not that I wasn't supposed to like them and love them and be friends with them, but we are the true church, not them. They apostatized. We actually are the true church. We started with Joseph Smith in 1830. They left us. That was the story. Well, that's not the story at all. So, yeah. So it's unfortunate. I break away from basically most of the heritage history of my church because I say, no, Joseph, I actually believe the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints actually, you know, when you look at Joseph Smith's teachings, especially in 1844 before he dies, they do keep a lot of the tradition alive. They do not break away from us. William Bickerton came out much later. So you see, it's very controversial. So the sources are good. That's how I cite them. I cite them to the appropriate archives. You can see them. My hope now is to, with copyright and working with John Mancini, who has the original minutes, he has given me permission, which I did not have. I only had to write the book. He has given me permission to pursue publishing the minutes. So I'm working to do that. It's going to take some time because it's over 2,000 pages. There's also Revelation books that are in there. One of them that was thought to be lost is now in the church archive. I was able to find. No one knew it was there. John has Revelation books that need to be presented. So I'm basically working. Do I publish all of them? Is there a publisher interested? I'm talking with Signature. We're trying to work something out. But we have to figure out, is it going to be an abridgment? Is it going to be the whole thing? I don't know. And, you know, there's obviously, you know, money involved and, you know, things like that and copyright issues. So it's something I have to work on. But it's my next project that I'm working on. Am I rambling? Am I? No, okay. Okay. So this is so basically, I guess the long story short, I had to be a historian but also a politician, which I never signed up to be a politician in church politics, but it's you know, it is what it is, and I'm glad it's out, because you know, it's a really good story. At least I really appreciated it, and I learned a lot, and most of the stuff I did not know. I basically knew so little, and I know so much more about my movement than I did, and we evolved quite a bit over time, and I think that's hard to, within any movement, it's hard to swallow when you've been told something your whole life, you're invested into it, because we are a weird tradition. Well, I don't want to say we're a weird tradition, but we're very similar to Catholicism in a lot of ways, of that theology and history are like this. They're intertwined, right? Protestants, a lot of Protestants really don't have that much issue. You talk to a Lutheran and you talk about all these different scandalous things that Martin Luther did, nobody cares. Most people don't. But if you talk about scandalous things that Joseph Smith or William Bickerton or Joseph Smith III did, oh, those are fighting words. So it's hard. Our history and our theology are completely intertwined. So there's the controversy behind that. So there are limited sources, but the sources that are there, as Chris had brought up, are beautiful. They're rich. They offer a brand new interpretation, a very unique interpretation to the Restoration movement that has never been presented before. So it's a lot of fun. So I talked about the importance of narrative. Basically, like, he was very democratic with Revelation. If I were to sum up the Bickertonite movement, it's this. They are an evangelical, revivalist church that believes in the Book of Mormon. That's what they are. So they get rid of a lot of the later teachings of Joseph Smith, plurality of gods or exaltation, baptism for the dead, polygamy. Those things are gone. William Bickerton goes back to his early Methodist roots. And basically, and really the early Restoration, there's a lot, you know, Chris Jones and a lot of other great scholars, they talk about the similarities between Methodism and Mormonism. Bickerton fits within that narrative. More work needs to be done on that. Basically, if anybody wants to do work on Bickerton, please do so. I was hoping this would be a starting point to start conversations. I know people are going to disagree with this. I know the interpretations we're going to go off in different ways. But I was hoping this would be the trunk of what would hope to become a beautiful tree. And in the end, I stand firm on all my interpretations. I'm very open to kind of reworking them. And as you get older, as Chris says, and you look at things, you go, okay, well, maybe you start thinking more about different things. But the foundation of what I've written, I'm still very proud of personally for me. And I know that regardless of what things are coming out, I know that the meat of it, that all of it's there, it's real and it's true. And I stand by those interpretations. And I'm very thankful for that. So, I think I talked about all those things. Controversy, Forgotten Latter-day Prophet, negotiations, all those different things. So, yeah.
You did great.
Thank you. Appreciate it.